Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Cisco Food Services versus Chatmel.
May it please the court. Mr. Frankie Weatherett will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. This cause presents this court with questions regarding the defensive use of issue preclusion based upon federal court judgment. In a Federal Tort Claims Act case arising out of the death in 1984 of Susan Trapnell, allegedly from eating foods which allegedly contained sulfites at the Officers Club of Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas. Susan's death resulted in not one lawsuit, but two. A Federal Tort Claims Act lawsuit in federal court in Corpus Christi and a products liability suit in state court in Corpus Christi. The federal judge, following bench trial, found for the Navy in the Tort Claims Act litigation, rendered judgment for the Navy, following which the product defendants moved for summary judgments in state court. The trial court granted those summary judgments, yet the Court of Appeals reversed and has remanded all of the claims for trial with the exception of the adult claims against some of the defendants because those claims are barred by limitations. That question is not before the court. With the court's permission, I should like to focus my remarks this morning upon three major issues. First is the clear and present danger of inconsistent judgments in this case if the plaintiffs are not precluded from relitigating the fact findings made by the federal court. Second, I should like to challenge the lower court's rather remarkable holding that trial courts in the state of Texas are handcuffed and the keys have been thrown away from ever applying issue preclusion based upon federal court litigation to the bench trial, to the bench where there was not a right to a trial by jury because of the Texas Constitution. And third, I should like to also challenge the lower court's adoption of the doctrine of alternative liability in this case and its use to prevent the trial court from exercising its discretion to apply issue preclusion based upon the federal court judgment.
Excuse me, Mr. Weatherford. I guess I need a little bit of preliminary help on this. The federal trial judge decided that this potato whitener had not been used in the fruit salad.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the fact finding that's really at issue, apparently.
It's one of two fact findings.
Okay. What is the other fact finding that's at issue?
The potato white fact finding is the one that has received the lion's share of the briefing. But the second fact finding is also important, that being that in the early 1980s, the United States Navy was well aware of the alleged dangers of sulfites in foods, yet made a policy decision to continue serving foods that contain sulfites at its installations throughout the world. That went to the discretionary function holding by the federal judge in the Federal Tort Claims Act case, which disposed of all of the plaintiff's claims except for one.
Now, it's, well, keep on my train of thought here. The plaintiff's expert, well, how do we get to the situation that, one, only the potato, the whitener used in the fruit salad is an issue in the state case, if that, in fact, is what's happening, and, two, I guess, aren't the defendants arguing that the only issue in the state case is whether or not potato whitener was used in the fruit salad?
But for issue preclusion,
okay,
the only issue in state court would be the potato whitener issue because the plaintiff's own expert has said that in order for the apple pie filling to do it, it would have been inedible. And in order for the hash browns to do it, she would have had to have eaten between 2 and 3 pounds of hash browns.
So to get to the issue preclusion issue, the defendants are relying on the plaintiff's expert that excludes the other foodstuffs that had this sulfide in it. I mean, I'm just asking the question. To get to issue preclusion, it is premised on the plaintiff's expert narrowing the products that could have caused this death.
Well, if we're partially relying upon Dr. Simon's first affidavit. When I say we, that's the royal we, because after all, I'm arguing on behalf of all of the defendants, potato white and non-potato white. The reason the potato white defendants win is because of issue preclusion. The reason that the non-potato white defendants win is because of Dr. Simon's first affidavit. Because Dr. Simon has said it was not the apple pie filling and it was not the hash brown. Dr. Simon had an opinion based upon assumptions that it must have been the potato whitener on the fruit salad. Judge Head found it was not the potato. There was no potato whitener on the fruit salad. Our product wasn't even there. So Hirsch Celanese, whose only connection to the lawsuit is the alleged presence of potato whitener on the fruit salad, wins because the product wasn't there.
I want to be clear that it is reliance on Dr. Simon's affidavit that gets us to the issue preclusion problem.
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that. It's the relevance of Dr. Simon's first affidavit is to the non-potato whitener defendants, but there would be an issue preclusion issue in this case,
well,
regardless of what Dr. Simon's first affidavit said, because...
As to the defendants who provide the potato whitener.
Yes, Your Honor.
But not as to the other.
But okay. As to the non-potato white defendants, The way they get to issue preclusion is because of Dr. Simon's first affidavit.
Okay. Going to your second issue that you mentioned, that of the Navy's decision to continue using sulfites, you're saying on that issue the non-potato white providers win?
That goes to conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
That finding, that's why the potato white finding got the lion's share of the briefing.
Okay. Thank you.
Having identified the facts that were found by Judge Head and having reviewed why those facts should be dispositive in this case, I would like to turn to what I consider to be a clear and present danger of inconsistent judgments in this case if there is no preclusion. Why is that important? That is important because, contrary to the position taken by the plaintiffs in this case, judicial efficiency is not the only purpose of issue preclusion. One of the primary purposes of issue preclusion is to prevent inconsistent judgments. Now, what is the potential for inconsistent judgments in this case if the plaintiffs are not precluded from relitigating the potato whitener finding? There are two. Number one, if we take the plaintiffs at their word, and they are allowed to relitigate the finding that was fully and fairly litigated in federal court that there was no potato whitener on the fruit salad, they are almost certain they're going to obtain a judgment against the defendants. Such a judgment would necessarily be based upon a finding that potato whitener was on the fruit salad. Absolutely the opposite of the finding in federal court. So that's your first inconsistency. Judgment for the Navy, no potato whitener. Judgment against the product defendants, potato whitener. It doesn't stop there.
For the Cisco was not part of the federal action, was it? The potato whitener defendant?
None of the product defendants were parties to the federal court action, Your Honor.
So how then did the Trentinals get a full and fair hearing on this potato whitener issue if none of the parties were before the federal court, if they were not defendants before the federal court?
Your Honor, full and fair, the full and fair litigation element.
In other words, no one denies what killed the woman. No one denies what killed her, the cause of her death.
I disagree.
Sulfites. Oh, what killed her then?
It is not undisputed that it was sulfites in one of the foods she allegedly ate that killed her.
Is there any place else she could have gotten sulfites?
Yes, Your Honor. Susan Trapnell had a history of sulfite sensitivity and, in fact, had been to an emergency room somewhere in the world at least 20 times before this incident. Some of those occasions did not involve ingesting food. There was evidence that it could be cigarette smoke. There was evidence it could be smog, pollution. There was evidence that it could have been grape drink that she drank at church that morning. It is not undisputed. You will hear the plaintiff say that it is undisputed what killed her. And the record does not bear that out. It is not undisputed. And the full and fair litigation requirement referred to in your question, I want to stress, is whether or not the plaintiff had the full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue in that forum. And according to the restatement, when the trial court is exercising its discretion to determine whether or not there has been a full and fair opportunity to litigate, what the court is really supposed to focus on is, was it a court of record? Was it a plenary as opposed to a summary proceeding? Was there a right to an appeal? And most importantly, was there discovery available, normal discovery available procedures, and did the plaintiff have the incentive and the motivation to try the heck out of that issue? And in this case, that's what the court is supposed to focus on. And the plaintiffs in this case knew absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was going to be the most important issue in their case in state court. They had all of the means of discovery at their beckon.
Why did the trial court, the federal trial court, find that there were no sulfites, that there was no potato washer on the fruit salad? Was that relevant to the outcome? That was federal tort claims.
Absolutely relevant. That is an absolutely essential and necessary finding.
How is it relevant? Is that the basis for the holding?
There was a claim made by the plaintiffs in federal court that was not disposed of by the discretionary function exception to the Federal Tort Claims Act. One claim hanging out there that the Navy had lied to Benjamin Trapnell when he came in and asked on behalf of his wife, is there potato whitener on that fruit salad? They alleged that the cook lied to him. Judge Head had to tackle that issue head on, and he found that the cook had not lied because, quote, the staff of the officers' club did not use potato whitener when it prepared the fruit salad, close quote. Absolutely essential, absolutely necessary to his fact finding. The plaintiff's important point, full and fair opportunity to litigate. The plaintiffs did not need to join the product defendants to get a full and fair hearing in federal court. They could have introduced all of the evidence they wanted to on these different products. But be that as it may, the plaintiffs could have joined in the federal action every single products defendant except for Cisco. And Cisco's joinder was not necessary to a just resolution of the issues because Cisco is nothing but a middleman. Every product defendant was diverse as to the plaintiffs except for Cisco. And that point pervades my entire argument because the lower court has now shackled trial courts in the state of Texas that you can't apply issue preclusion because of our state constitution and its right to a jury trial. Well, the plaintiffs waived any right to a jury trial under the state constitution, and they waived it because they made a conscious decision not to join the diverse product defendants in federal court. And what would have happened had they joined the diverse product defendants is that under the Seventh Amendment to the United States Constitution, under the Beacon Theaters case from the U.S. Supreme Court, and under the Lytle case from the U.S. Supreme Court, they would have had a right to a jury trial as to the product defendants in federal court. Now, they would have still been required to try their Tort Claims Act case against the Navy to the bench. That's true. But they would have been entitled to a jury trial as to the product defendants. They would have been entitled to that jury trial before the bench trial. And the federal judge could not do anything in the bench trial to nullify the effect of the jury's verdict as to the product defendants.
So if the jury concluded that the plaintiff had made a case that these products, the potato whitener manufactured by these defendants, had been in the fruit salad, the federal judge could not have overridden that, so to speak, in the non-jury trial against the Navy.
Interestingly enough, the federal judge possibly could have still found as to the Navy that potato whitener was not on the fruit salad, as contradictory as that sounds. But the federal judge could not let his decision as to the Navy affect entering judgment based upon the verdict of the jury as to the product defendants. And we wouldn't be here. And the plaintiffs wouldn't be saddled with issue preclusion. It's through their own fault.
If they'd have tried the whole thing in the federal forum, they would not be subject to issue preclusion. That's what you're saying.
Well,
but since they chose to bifurcate their claims between the state and federal system, they are subject to issue preclusion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it was their choice to do that. I would also like to point out to the court on the jury trial issue that before you even get to waiver, you first of all have to decide, was there a right to a jury trial under the Texas Constitution that attached in this case? No. There was no right, because whether you're talking about Article 1, Section 15 or Article 5, Section 10, the right to a jury trial in the state of Texas has never been held to be absolute. It's always subject to some kind of limitation, the most important of which is this court's summary judgment practice, this court's instructed verdict practice, and this court's JNOV practice. There is no right to a jury trial in the state of Texas except as to genuine issues of material fact. And the potato whitener issue is not a genuine issue, because a rule of law, specifically issue preclusion, says the court cannot consider it. And therefore, it's not a genuine issue, and the right to a jury trial never even attached because of issue preclusion. So you don't need to get to waiver. But if you get to waiver, they waived it, they could have joined the diverse defendants. But even if the right attached, and even for purposes of argument, we assume that there hasn't been any waiver, the federal common law of issue preclusion, which says that it doesn't matter whether there was a right to a jury trial in the first litigation, that's Park Lane hosiery, that's federal common law, through the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, with all due respect to our own state constitution, preempts any right to a jury trial under our state constitution. And it does so because of the unique federal interest in this case in finality of litigation as to the Navy, and the obvious conflict between what the Court of Appeals in this case has held and what the Supreme Court held in Park Lane hosiery. And the reason that the Navy is still at stake here is the second inconsistency that I was going to describe. Because if a judgment is obtained against the product defendants in state court, rest assured they are going to seek contribution from the United States Navy, because they wouldn't be liable but for the finding that potato whitener was on the fruit salad, which must mean that the Navy did lie to Benjamin Trapnell. So we go across the street to the federal courthouse in Corpus Christi, and we ask the Navy to contribute. One of two things is going to happen. It's an either-or situation. Either the Navy is going to be ordered to to pay contribution, which confronts the Navy with inconsistent judgments, judgment against the plaintiffs that there was no potato whitener on the fruit salad versus a judgment that they have to contribute to our liability because they lied and there was potato whitener on the fruit salad, or the Navy is going to say, we don't owe contribution. Our liability to the plaintiff has been extinguished by an adverse judgment. Contribution's derivative in the state of Texas. Therefore, these product defendants don't have any right to contribution from us. And if the court buys that argument, well, then we are confronted with inconsistent judgments yet again. We have to pay the plaintiff because we put potato whitener on the fruit salad, but the Navy doesn't have to contribute because there wasn't a potato whitener on the fruit salad. Those are the inconsistencies, and clearly the state court, again, with due respect to our Texas Constitution, was out of line in shackling the trial court and throwing away the key on being able to exercise its discretion to apply issue preclusion.
I can't recall whether the Court of Appeals focused on the lack of a right to jury trial under the Federal Tort Claims Act in their suit against the Navy, or the mere absence of a jury trial.
They acknowledged that there was no right to a jury trial under the Federal Tort Claims Act, and they basically said to the feds, you guys can do whatever you want to, but we're not going to let issue preclusion be based upon a non-jury trial.
Well, that was my concern, is can the Court of Appeals opinion, in your view, be read so broadly as to say there is no issue preclusion as a result of a non-jury trial, whether it's in state or federal court?
Unless there was a right to a jury trial in the initial litigation and it was waived by the plaintiffs, which, of course, Baker versus Story says that a plaintiff can waive its constitutional right to a jury trial and therefore not be able to avoid issue preclusion on that basis. And we have waiver in this case, too, because they could have had a jury trial in federal court. But the Court of Appeals opinion, I'm afraid, is awfully broad. But the easiest way for this court to deal with the situation is to say, we never get to the Constitution of Texas in the first place, or if we do, it's been waived. Finally,
Mr. Weather, before you make the final point, let me just go back and ask you a question with regards to cause of death. The Court of Appeals apparently was convinced in reading the Federal District Court's order that the cause of death was sulfide consumption, and they state that in opinion in a very different way. You disagree with that?
Well, the word consumption. I disagree with any statement, either express or implied, that it must have been from consuming sulfites contained in one of the foods on Susan's plate. But if by consumption you also include the grape juice that she had at church or what she inhaled before she came into the officers' club, no.
Any other questions?
Is there any evidence that at any point she ingested by one means or another, through food, through inhalation, a sufficient quantity of sulfites to cause mortality other than what she ate on her plate?
Well, first of all, it's highly speculative as to what she ate on her plate at the officers' club. I have pored over this record, Your Honor, and
was there no evidence, no testimony from family members as to what she had on her plate and what she ate?
There was testimony as to what she had on her plate, but there is hardly a scintilla of evidence as to what she actually ate on her plate. However, she would have needed to eat 2 or 3 pounds of hash browns.
Okay, so lemonade hash browns, as apple pie and fruit salad.
Would have been apple pie filling, by their own plaintiff's testimony, would have been inedible. She couldn't have eaten it.
That leaves what?
Well, that leaves potato whitener if you assume that it had to be one of the foods on her plate, and it's not undisputed that it was one of the foods on her plate. But even if it was undisputed that it was one of the foods on her plate, to put it bluntly, it's the plaintiff's fault that we're here in the first place, because once again...
Shouldn't have eaten this stuff, huh?
No. Should have tried it in federal court, where they could have, as to all of the defendants except for Cisco.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
please the court. Mr. Randall Kasura and Mr. Russell Manning will present arguments for the respondents. Mr. Kasura will present the first 3 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. I am representing First Foods Company, who allegedly manufactured a product called Potato White that allegedly ended up on a salad bar, a fruit salad, that Ms. Trapnell says, her husband says, that she consumed just moments before her death. We are not before the court as petitioners today. We are cast as respondents. And the reason we are cast as respondents is simply that we had a motion for summary judgment which was filed in the Trapnell 2 opinion that had to do with the causation issue. This court, in its wisdom, decided not to grant writ on that. And that case, having been severed, is now again pending in the district court. First Foods currently has a motion for summary judgment pending also on the collateral estoppel issue. But in fairness to all the parties today, I believe the real battle should be between Mr. Weather and Mr. Manning. I just wanted the court to know that we are here cast as respondents. I do not incorporate any of the arguments, however, made by our co-respondent. We would adopt Mr. Weather's arguments today.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
State Police Court.
My understanding from your pleadings, you indicate that you've not joined all possible defendants in this case. Is that right?
In fact, we have joined all possible defendants in this case, except for the United States Navy. And it was not possible for us to join the Navy because jurisdiction does not lie in the state courts for an action against the United States. We were required to file that case in the United States federal court.
Have you joined all manufacturers of potato whitener?
We have not joined all manufacturers of potato whitener. And the case was originally asserted against the current and many other manufacturers of potato whitener. At the time, it was not known who the manufacturers were whose sulfites ended up in the products that were on Susan Trapnell's plate. Through discovery, we have traced the purchases of sulfites from the food processors, and their suppliers have traced those to the manufacturers who are parties to the case. So we have identified everyone who is responsible for placing the three suspect food products or their components into the stream of commerce.
This court's never embraced the concept of alternative liability. Those jurisdictions where the theory has been adopted that it's a prerequisite that all potential defendants be joined, properly disposing the cause. Back in 1989, this court specifically did reject alternative liability theory in that case because all tortfeasors or all potential tortfeasors were not joined. Without the Navy, you're now saying that through discovery and whatnot, you have eliminated any other potential tortfeasors than those that you have joined in this cause. So you claim now that you do have all potential defendants joined.
That is,
which this court would have any jurisdiction.
That's correct. And along the lines of the Court of Appeals analysis in this case, we do have, even without the Navy being present in the case, at least one party in the stream of commerce or the stream of distribution for each one of the three suspect products. So there are people in the case as defendants who are responsible for placing each one of the three suspect products in the stream of commerce. Those are the only three possible causes of Susan Trapnell's death under the record that is before this court. There is no medical testimony of any kind or other testimony that is non-medical, that anything other than those three products could have caused Susan Trapnell's death on this occasion.
What did the counsel mean when he told us about the grape juice?
The grape juice that the counsel referred to is not actually in the summary judgment record in this case. It is a statement that was made by the federal district court in its opinion in the federal litigation. And even in that situation, the federal judge acknowledged that that grape juice was not the type that contained sulfites. In addition, the medical testimony does indicate, and it's not controverted, that this type of reaction is an instantaneous type of reaction. It's one that the person who eats the food suffers very soon after consuming the food and not after a long period of time has passed. So the shortest time in which this reaction could have begun was 3 to 5 minutes. The longest period of time in which this reaction could have begun is within 10 to 15 minutes after ingesting the food. And the reason for this is that what actually causes the reaction in people who are sensitive to sulfites is that the powdered form of sulfite dissolves in the system and is released into a gaseous form. And so it is only available to cause a reaction for as long as it is in a gaseous form, and eventually, of course, it will be released either after having caused a reaction or having not caused a reaction.
You're saying then, contrary to what opposing counsel has said, you're saying that the record shows that it is undisputed that she died from ingesting sulfites that were on the food that was on her plate in the officer's club at the Naval Air Station, Corpus Christi.
That's correct.
That's undisputed.
Sorry. Under the record that is before this court, it is not disputed by any competent evidence, other than counsel's speculation that because Ms. Trapnell on a prior occasion had a problem with smoke or a problem with other substances, he's speculating that could have been the cause here, but there's no evidence.
Does the medical evidence show that she died from sulfites that were on food that she ingested?
Yes.
That was on her plate.
There are two affidavits that are competent on this issue. One is from our expert, Dr. Simon. The other is from the defendant's expert, Dr. Steve Taylor. They both give the same opinion, that she had to have died from sulfites in food on her plate that day, and there are only three possible causes: potato whitener, hash browns, and apple pie filling.
Was that conclusion based on an autopsy?
It was not based upon an autopsy. There was not an autopsy done.
Well, what was it based on? It was speculation.
It was based on her prior medical history as having been confirmed as sensitive to sulfites and having had extensive workups for sensitivity and allergies. This is the only substance.
This is the only thing she ingested within the time frame that you're talking about. They went to the buffet at the officer's club. They were there, what, half hour before she collapsed?
3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes.
Mr. Manning.
Well, if there was no autopsy, then who determined the cause of death?
The official cause of death on the death certificate is anaphylactic reaction. And
who made that determination?
That determination was made by a combination of Navy physicians who treated Ms. Trapnell at the Naval Hospital and doctors at Spahn Hospital who were her attending physicians at the time she died.
Mr. Manning, the issue about potato whitener, or whatever this is, it seems to me the petitioner is arguing that Dr. Simon's affidavit essentially focuses the entire case on whether or not potato whitener was on the fruit salad, and the federal judge's finding that it was not on the fruit salad disposes of this case. You are again emphasizing that there are three items that were on the plate that had sulfites in them. Is it your position that statement that this case really resolved around potato white is incorrect, that regardless of whether we have issue preclusion, you still have a cause of action for the sulfites in the other food?
Yes.
Or do you concede that your your own expert says it was either on the fruit salad or it wasn't.
That's the issue. In fact, if issue preclusion is applied in this case, the court will still have to deal with the question of whether there is some evidence in the summary judgment record to indicate causation by hash browns and apple pie filling. And in that connection, after the trial court granted the summary judgment in favor of John Hogan Interests, which was later reversed, Dr. Simon prepared a supplemental affidavit assuming, as the summary judgment that had then been granted required him to assume, and as the application of issue preclusion would require a jury to assume, that potato whitener was not a potential cause of death. In that instance, Dr. Simon issued the supplemental affidavit revising his opinion that if required to assume that, then the only sources for the sulfites that could have caused her death were the apple pie filling and the hash browns.
How do you, taking what you said at face value for present purposes, how do you get around the Judge Head's factual determination that potato whitener was not added to the food?
Well, I think for purposes of collateral estoppel analysis, it is important for us to recognize what the actual elements are for collateral estoppel or issue preclusion, and then to look at other factors that would make its application unfair in this particular case. First of all, we should recognize that this is a case of non-mutual issue preclusion. None of the parties who are defendants in this case have ever litigated any of the issues in this case. And that brings to bear...
So you are arguing on their behalf that there have been harmed in some way because of that opportunity? Yeah, see, you got it backwards.
I'm sorry.
The harm is that the plaintiff has not had an opportunity to fully litigate the issue. Not the defendants have been absent, they have been denied an opportunity.
Correct.
I hear your argument, correct me if I'm wrong, that because the defendants have not had a full opportunity to litigate this issue, that they have been harmed, and that harm endures to your benefit.
I did not intend to convey that impression. What I intended to convey, the application of issue preclusion is much easier to determine and has less likelihood of unfairness to the precluded party when the issue was litigated between both or all of the parties who are present in the second case.
I'd like to back up a minute if I can while you're on that. The other side, in response to the question I asked earlier, was stated that the federal trial court's determination that there was no potato whitener on the fruit salad was a necessary material and necessary element of its finding. The government did not lie in the Federal Tort Claims Act case. Can we discuss that for a minute?
Okay. That was the evidentiary reasoning by which the federal court decided the ultimate issue in that case, which was whether the Navy was negligent. The case law in both federal and state court discussing the application of issue preclusion requires not only that the issue was litigated in the prior case, but that it was an ultimate or controlling issue in that case and in this case. In this case, the controlling issues, as this court has explained in the Tarter versus Metropolitan Savings and Loan Association case, controlling issues are those that constitute the elements of the cause of action. And the elements of the cause of action against the Navy were, was the Navy negligent? Was the negligence a cause of death? And if so, what compensation should be awarded? The issues in this case on product liability claims are, was a product defective? If it was defective, was the defect the cause of death? And if so, what compensation should be awarded?
What was the basis of the negligence claim against the Navy?
There were many bases for the negligence claim against the Navy. One was the Navy's decision to use potato whitener at all or to fail to warn about potato whitener. The federal court determined that those, that basis was barred by the discretionary function exception. We presented in this case, in the summary judgment evidence, and in the federal case, three factual scenarios, all supported by evidence, by which sulfites could have ended up in the potato, in the fruit salad that was served to Susan Trapnell. The first scenario presented was that the two cooks, Roberto Mangohig and Mr. Ortiz, I can't recall his first name, that they actually prepared the fruit salad with potato whitener. That basis the federal court clearly rejected. Second basis was that other employees involved in the making of that fruit salad could have used potato whitener without the other two cooks knowing about it. That basis the federal court clearly rejected. The third basis was that fruit that had been served at a party the night before and likely had been treated with sulfites, as the evidence shows that when there are banquets or parties, the fruit is prepared with sulfites. There was also evidence that that fruit that was left over was used to replenish the fruit bowl the day that Susan Trapnell died. We presented that scenario as a possibility on how sulfites ended up in the fruit bowl. The federal court judgment does not address that factual basis at all. And
you mean the replenishment of the fruit bowl with leftover fruit?
Correct. The federal court does not address that factual basis whatsoever.
Necessarily found that against you, didn't you?
I don't think so. I think that the federal courts, the duty that the federal court found was to accurately state whether the cook had used sulfites in the preparation of the fruit bowl. Those are the words that the federal court uses. And in fact, if the fruit from the night before had been used to replenish the fruit bowl, the cook, not knowing about that, would not have had the duty to disclose that information, according to the basis that the federal court gave to find the duty.
Well, he either knew or should have known.
There is a should have known standard, and whether the federal court would have imposed a should have known standard is not addressed in the federal court's decision.
Well, is negligence against the government any different than our typical definition of knew or should have known?
No.
Okay. So it necessarily would have included should have known.
It would have, even though the federal court did not
specify that.
Correct.
With regard to your right to trial by jury, isn't opposing counsel correct that you could have joined all of these product defendants except for Cisco and gotten your jury trial with reference to them?
No, not exactly. And the reason it is not correct is this. The federal case could not be filed until the Navy considered an administrative claim that the Federal Tort Claims Act requires to be filed in those cases. The state case was filed in May 1988 while that administrative claim was still pending. At that time, most of the defendants whose identities we knew initially were Texas corporations. Cisco was the only current defendant whose identity was known to the plaintiffs at the time the original complaint was filed. The federal court case was not filed until December of 1988, after limitations had expired on the adult plaintiff's claims. Therefore, it was not possible to escape the limitations bar in the federal case. And we were presented with a decision in May of 1988, where do we file our case? Because we had state corporations who were defendants, we could not file in federal court. There was no federal court jurisdiction. We were forced to file the original claim in state court. And we recognized that because of the mandatory federal jurisdiction and Tort Claims Act, that we were going to have to bifurcate that trial in some way or another and have to decide which parties are going to be defendants in the federal case and which are going to be parties in the state case. All appearances to us were that the state case was going to be tried first, and because it was possible to join all of the manufacturers and distributors in the state case, we made a judgment at that time, and also in order to avoid the expiration of limitations, we made a judgment at that time to try all of the products liability defendants in state court.
Be sure that I'm following you. Because of the administrative requirement present in federal tort claims case, limitations would have run as the adult claims before you had an opportunity to file your case in federal court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So in order to preserve your cause, you had to go file it in the state court. You couldn't file it in the federal court because the administrative requirements, predicates, were still ongoing in the federal situation. You could not file your case in federal court. You had to get into court before limitations. Limitations continue to run even if it's in the administrative process.
Well, it certainly run on parties who are not parties to the administrative process.
So you had to file in state court. Did you, in fact, have a trial setting in state court that was abated by the trial court so that some of the defendants, parties defended in state court, could go intervene in the federal case?
Yes. The actual procedural chronology is that the federal court abated or stayed the federal case, having made the judgment that the state case should proceed first, and stayed the case on the condition that the federal case would not be reinstated until the state case were tried. Approximately 2 or 3 months after the federal court did that, the state court abated the case until the federal case were tried.
Effectively depriving you of your constitutional.
Yes, and we did seek and obtained a writ of mandamus ordering the trial court conditionally to vacate the order of abatement and to have the case set for trial. The case was set for trial at a time that had the abatement not been granted, and had we gone to trial as number one on the docket, as the record shows, we were set first on the docket, the state case would have been tried before the federal case.
So if you waived anything, it certainly wasn't voluntary, was it?
Absolutely not voluntary. In fact, we did everything we could to bring the state case to trial first, and the defendants persuaded the trial court to unconstitutionally abate that case. In fact, part of the trial court's abatement included a renewal of the abatement order in January of 1990 that also ordered the plaintiffs to file a motion in federal court seeking reinstatement of that federal case, and which we did in compliance with that order even while we were seeking mandamus. During the pendency of the Court of Appeals decision whether or not to issue a writ of mandamus, the federal judge called us and had become apprised of the situation and told us we were going to trial in 2 weeks, and that's how we ended up going to trial in the federal case before going to trial in this case.
At the time of the abatement, was it too late to join these product defendants in federal action? The statute run?
The statute had run as to the adult plaintiffs. Nicholas Trapnell, who's still now only about 10 or 11 years old, is a minor, so limitations hasn't begun to run on his claims. But the adult plaintiffs would not, although the evidence could have been presented in federal court, the adult plaintiffs could not have received any relief or judgment in federal court.
I think I understand the unusual situation federalism placed you in. Going back to the very first, it would have been possible, I think, to file a products case in federal court, not naming the Navy and not naming Cisco, but naming everyone else before limitations ran, and then adding the Navy subsequently after the administrative appeal was concluded. Is that correct?
Had we had the foresight to know what's going
to happen? Had you not, you would have done that rather than be here.
Absolutely. But the unfairness of the situation is that we were forced to make that choice. And not only were we forced to make that choice, but we were forced to make that choice with a crystal ball, knowing which case was going to be tried first, because most certainly, had we done what has been suggested and joined as many defendants as possible in federal court and Cisco and state court, and the state case gone first, then we would be having this same argument in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals or United States Supreme Court on whether the state court judgment collaterally stopped or precluded litigation of an issue.
Will you remind me how your claim, your administrative claim you have to make against the federal government, you have to make a claim, and even if it's not denied, you after 6 months you can file suit. Is that correct? Or is the timetable different?
If limitations expires during the consideration of the administrative claim, then limitations is extended for an additional 6 months after the claim is denied.
And what's your statute of limitations against the Navy?
2 years. And because it had expired from the date of the denial of the administrative claim, then we had 6 months within which to file. And of course, we filed as quickly as we could. I would like to address the jury right argument, because the non-mutual nature of this case, I think, eliminates the federal interest in requiring the application of issue preclusion in this case. The United States Supreme Court in the Lytle case pronounced three benefits or purposes for issue preclusion: to protect the parties from relitigating issues that were litigated in the first case, to protect the parties from having their rights determined in an inconsistent manner through inconsistent judgments, and to promote judicial economy. Because this is a non-mutual situation, no one is attacking the judgment in federal court. The decision that the Navy was not negligent is not going to be affected by the judgment in this case. It may be affected by action taken after the judgment, but it's not going to be affected by the judgment in this case. None of the rights of the defendants in this case were adjudicated in the first case. Therefore, the purpose of protecting them from inconsistent decisions does not apply in this case.
There is a risk of inconsistent fact findings underlying the judgments, is there not?
There is a possibility that a jury in this case would view the evidence differently than the federal court and reach a decision by viewing the evidence differently. But it is not the appearance of inconsistent outcomes that issue preclusion seeks to prevent. It is the actual inconsistent determination of the ultimate issues, the elements of the claim.
So you're saying it turns on the inconsistency of the judgment and not the fact findings?
It turns on the inconsistency of the decision on the elements of the cause of action. The elements of the cause of action, the federal case that were determined, the only one that was determined was the Navy negligent. And there's not going to be a finding on ultimate issues in this case that will be inconsistent with the United States District Court's determination that the Navy was not negligent. But the evidentiary reasoning of both may not be the same, but that is not what issue preclusion seeks to avoid. It seeks to avoid inconsistent decisions on ultimate issues, because the rights of the parties could be affected by inconsistent issue determinations, the ultimate issues. And since these parties have never litigated their case, they're not subject to duplicate litigation. That leaves really, in this case, not, for non-mutual issue preclusion to apply, only one benefit that is a potential benefit, and that is conservation of judicial resources. Do the state courts of Texas want to litigate this claim? And the federal courts do not have an interest in telling state courts, such as Texas, how to allocate their judicial resources.
Are there any further questions?
You still contend that this federal lawsuit is not entitled to deference because of denial of right to trial by jury? Or are you focusing your argument on the lack of inconsistency between ultimate issues?
I think the most important is lack of inconsistency on ultimate issues. But taking that as a given, the reason that the preservation of a jury trial in this case in state court would not run afoul of the federal court's judgment is even the United States Supreme Court, in situations of non-mutual issue preclusion, gives trial courts discretion not to apply non-mutual collateral estoppel even when it is available. And if trial courts have the discretion to do so, the highest courts of this state ought to also have the discretion to tell its trial courts how to exercise discretion and that it must do so in a manner that is consistent with the Texas state constitution. And then the second thing is the United States Supreme Court, in the Lytle opinion, reversed itself on whether or not the availability of a jury is a procedural difference that could change the outcome. Barkley and Hosiery was decided on the basis of the court's determination at that time that whether a judge tried the case or a jury tried the case was a neutral fact. The Lytle case came along and said the exact opposite. We now say that a jury and a judge could reach different determinations in viewing the same evidence. And to the extent that Park Lane Hosiery is relied upon, that portion of Park Lane Hosiery has been implicitly overruled by the decision in Lytle, and enforcing the right to a trial by jury in this case would be very consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Lytle.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is he correct about Lytle?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe he is. Lytle is easily explained in the following manner. The court didn't step back from Park Lane at all. Park Lane was a situation where there was no question but that there was no right to a jury trial in the initial litigation at all, because the court was sitting in equity in the original action in Park Lane. The subsequent action, which was a different action, a separate action brought later, was a legal action where there would otherwise be a right to trial by jury. In Lytle, the actions were combined. The legal and equitable actions were combined in the first case. And the trial court erroneously dismissed the legal action when he shouldn't have. And had he not dismissed the legal action, then under the Beacon Theaters decision I referred to earlier, the plaintiff would have been entitled to a jury trial in the first action. So the difference, Lytle doesn't even have to talk about Park Lane, really, because it's just a question of whether or not in the first case was your right to trial by jury violated there. And in our case, just like in Park Lane, there was no right to a jury trial in the federal action with respect to the Federal Tort Claims Act. Now, I want to jump on remarks that were made by the respondent about not being able to sue everybody because he had to wait on his administrative remedy. That's just not the case. And he could have sued in both courts. It's done every day. He could have sued the diverse product defendants, initiated a diversity action, as Chief Justice Phillips acknowledged, in federal court before his administrative remedy was even exhausted as to the Navy, and then added the Navy. At the very same time, he could have sued not only Cisco, he could have sued the very same people he had sued in federal court, in state court. Either way, he would be entitled to a jury trial, whichever case went first. I would also like to point out on the alleged number one trial setting that was lost because of Judge Hunter's abatement. That was an October 1989 trial setting The plaintiffs were still adding defendants in this case in March of 1991, and I think it just defies the record to tell this court in a sort of Monday morning retrospective reconstruction of what might have happened that they were going to go to trial in October of 89 but for this abatement.
Counsel, opposing counsel said that there may not be issue preclusion here because there was another theory, that is a refreshing of the fruit bowl, which the federal court made no finding on. So there may not have been fair litigation on the point of how that could have gotten into this. Why do you disagree with that?
I disagree because picking up on something that Justice Cornyn asked, it's implicit in what Judge Head found, because Judge Head found that there was no potato white on the fruit salad, period, end of discussion. Because the question was whether the Navy knew or should have known, and did they lie to Benjamin Trapnell. And if there was any potato whitener on that fruit salad, I don't care how it got there, they would have been making an untruthful statement to Mr. Trapnell when he asked them, is there potato whitener on that fruit salad? And he found that they told the truth because there was no potato whitener on the fruit salad.
Now, if indeed this case were tried in state court, and the fruit salad defendants were found liable, could they not go to federal court against the Navy since they themselves have not litigated this question in federal court?
The Court of Appeals said that because of due process, we would be able to go into federal court and seek contribution from the Navy. I'm sure the Navy's going to have something to say about that if and when that happens. But if we were allowed to seek contribution from the United States Navy, it doesn't dissolve the problem of inconsistent judgments.
It does resolve. You alluded to a problem with perhaps you're being stuck with the whole judgment.
Yes.
But under additional collateral estoppel law, you could seek contribution to the federal district court. I mean, you would not be issue precluded. You might lose that case.
The law in Texas, Your Honor, as I understand it, is that if a defendant's liability to a plaintiff is extinguished by an adverse judgment, as a matter of law, no other defendant has a right of contribution against that defendant. Now, most of the decisions I have seen involve situations where all of the defendants were all in the same case at the same time. I'm not sure that issue has come up, and I'm not sure if that rule of law is based on estoppel principles or not. I think it might very well be based more on simply the nature of contribution being a derivative action. And so I'm not at all sure that the Navy couldn't argue that the due process clause is irrelevant here. We can't give them contribution because we have no liability against plaintiffs. You can't go back and change that.
But we're also not clear if state or federal law is applying that federal action. You're saying there's some open questions.
There's an open question there. It would be the state law of contribution, though, that would be applied in federal court if we have to go there.
And one final question. If the fruit salad clients prevail in this court, why doesn't Simon's second affidavit raise a fact issue for summary judgment purposes as to the combined negligence of the potato and apple pie?
It's very important to read Dr. Simon's second affidavit very, very carefully, because he didn't do what he could have done. As an expert, we're not saying that an expert can't revise his opinions. I see it done in discovery. He didn't go back and look at any facts, any data, anything, and say, well, I've looked at this data again, or I've got some new data, I've got some new information, and that makes me have to change my opinion because I'm an intellectually honest expert. What he said was that, well, I've been told that the first theory I had was wrong by a court of law. And because of that rule of law, I guess I've been told I was wrong about the potato whitener. Therefore, I must have been wrong about the apple pie filling and the hash browns in my first affidavit, yet he doesn't explain why he was wrong as to the apple pie filling or the hash browns, except to say, well, and again, this is without any inquiry on his part, no facts at all, just pure speculation, no basis for the opinion. He says, well, if I was wrong about the potato whitener, then there just must have been more sulfite in those foods than I was led to believe. And it's our position that that is absolutely no evidence for purposes of a summary judgment. That is terrible precedent to allow an expert, and I don't care how qualified the expert is, to simply change his mind in midstream based upon nothing more than a court ruling as opposed to facts.
I took all your time. Do you have any one concluding thing that you wanted to bring up regarding your respondent's argument?
I just wanted to respondent referred to discretion. It's in the application. I just wanted to briefly point out to the court that there are two Court of Appeals opinions that have come down recently that hold that in a summary judgment appeal, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. We are suggesting to the court that that does not do violence to this court's summary judgment practice at all, because the ultimate burden of proof never shifts from us as the movements on our affirmative defense. But once we make a prima facie case of the three elements of issue preclusion, if the non-movement brings up exceptions that are arguably applicable, fairness exceptions, there aren't any fact issues that would ever go to the jury on that anyway. It's for the trial court to exercise its discretion. The trial court in this case exercised his discretion to apply issue preclusion, and he should be affirmed just like the trial court was affirmed in the Fletcher case out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals, and just like the trial court was affirmed in the Tankersley case out of the Austin Court of Appeals, which I know this court denied the writ of error today in the Tankersley case.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the oral argument in this case and concludes the court's oral submission docket. Foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.